Welcome to the Equine Veterinary Education Podcasts.
Hi everyone and welcome. My name is Chiara Morelli and welcome to the Equine Veterinary Education Podcast. Today I'm thrilled to have with us Christopher Baldwin. Christopher graduated from the Royal Veterinary College in 2012 and undertook a two-year internship at the Newmarket Equine Hospital. After that, he worked for several years as an equine ambulatory vet in West Sussex and then completed an ECVS surgical residency and a certificate in equine soft tissue surgery. After completing this residency, Chris worked as a surgeon at Hambleton Equine Clinic before joining the equine hospital team at the University of Liverpool. Hi, Chris, how are you doing today?
Very well, thanks. Cara, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you. Today, we're going to talk about a review of prevention and management of castration complications. So what is the average complication rate, please?
So equine castration is one of the most commonly performed procedures, and complications rate vary. So anywhere between 10 and 60%, depending on what study you're looking at. And up to 14, 15% of castrations can have one or more intraoperative complications as well. So having multiple complications within the same surgery is also relatively common too. So equine practitioners shouldn't be too disheartened when they get either multiple intraoperative complications or if they have postoperative complications. This is although it's a relatively straightforward and commonly performed procedure, complications too are also pretty frequent.
Okay, and which are the most frequent complications?
So probably the most common would be to have some form of scrotal swelling or seroma development, and then that's followed by local or scrotal infection, and then also a hemorrhage would probably be like our top three kind of complications that we would expect following routine castration.
Okay, and how can we prevent those?
So just remembering our basic surgical principles, so remembering Halstead's principles is very important. So to have gentle tissue handling, asepsis, closing dead space where appropriate, and making sure we have a good hemostasis, those kind of things are all really important. But also having a good clinical exam of your patient and making sure that your patient is appropriate for the procedure that you're going to perform. So in castration, we've got multiple different options for castration. So we can do it in the standing patient, we can do it in the recumbent patient in the field, or we can bring the patient into the hospital and we can do it in a sterile operating theater. And then in terms of the castration procedure, we can do an open castration, a closed castration, or a semi-closed castration. So being aware of the pros and cons of all of the variety there that you can have with the three different procedures and the different ways that you can do it is important, as well as just having a good understanding of the anatomy. And then specifically for reducing complications, things like perioperative antimicrobials and perioperative and postoperative non-steroidal anti-inflammatories have also been shown to reduce complication rates.
And regarding the medication, what do you suggest and for how long?
So there are no real studies that look definitively at whether one antimicrobial is better than the other. But it has been shown that sodium penicillin given as a single dose or given as a three-day course, the three-day course is better. So that paper was Halketal in 2017. And what they found was that the horses had higher SAA and fibrinogen, and they cultured more bacteria more frequently if the horses just had a single dose of penicillin compared to the three-day course. So a three-day course of antimicrobials would be considered appropriate. And then in terms of what I use, I would either give procaine penicillin or I give oxytetracycline. And then in terms of non-steroidals, we know that SAA remains elevated for about 8 days postoperatively. So it seems reasonable to me that, you know, 1 week of non-steroidals is both, you know, good for equine welfare and also it's good for reducing your complications postoperatively. So I would give a full dose, a 4.4 mg per kg dose of phenylbutazone IV perioperatively, and then I'd follow this up with oral phenylbutazone 2.2 mg per kg BID for 5 days, because we know that if horses are feeling uncomfortable and they don't have sufficient analgesia on board, then they will stand still. And when horses stand still, they're more likely to get scrotal swelling. And if they get scrotal swelling, they're more likely to get a scrotal infection. So just in terms of good kind of like patient welfare, but also for reducing your complications, like I think a 5 day course of NSAIDs is appropriate.
Okay, what kind of surgical techniques can be used and what are the differences?
So broadly speaking, there's three types of castration techniques. So you're open, closed and half closed. So the open castration technique is where we incise into the parietal tunic and then we prolapse the testis. We then remove the testis and we leave the parietal tunic open. And in doing so, we leave a open communication from the abdominal cavity down through the inguinal ring into the open scrotum and via the open tunic. Now, the benefit of this open technique is that it is the technique that requires the least dissection. So using your blade, you'll cut through the scrotal skin and then you'll be able to prolapse out the parietal tunic. You can cut through the parietal tunic and then be able to prolapse out your testy. So it's two nice, clean incisions. And you do have to cut the caudal ligament of the epididymis just to fully free the testis. But it gives you great access to the testis and the spermatic cord and the vascular arcades. So that's the open castration technique. Minimal dissection, great access to the testes, but you do leave that open communication. Then on the other end of the spectrum, you've got the closed castration technique. So with this one, you need to dissect the parietal tunic from the scrotal fascia. This is not impossible to do standing, but it's quite challenging. It's far easier to do in the recumbent patient. It's a lot more kind of tissue dissection. And then what we do is we remove the testis and part of the parietal tunic, and then we close the parietal tunic either by the emasculating device, so either using a device that crushes and cuts, or by using something like the Henderson that twists and pulls, or we can also close the parietal tunic by placing a proximal transfixing ligature. The benefits of the closed castration is that you seal off the abdominal cavity from your scrotal incision in the outside world. So you keep abdominal content from escaping out into the outside world, but also potentially you keep bacteria out from wicking more proximally into the abdominal cavity. The final technique is the half-closed castration technique. So we approach the testis in the same way that we do for a closed castration. So we make a scrotal incision and then we dissect the parietal tunic from the scrotal fascia. And then we make an incision in the parietal tunic. And we do this at the distal end of the spermatic cord. And from that incision in the parietal tunic, we then prolapse the testis, the epididymis, and a portion of the spermatic vasculature and the spermatic cord. We then can ligate and transect and remove the testis. And then we also transect the parietal tunic from the testis and the epididymis. All of the testicle remnants of the, so the spermatic cord and the spermatic vasculature get put back into the parietal tunic, and then we can close the parietal tunic. Now, this half-closed castration technique has the highest incidence of complications, and that's likely due to a lot of tissue handling. It takes a lot longer to do, so your surgical time's increased, and there's just a higher chance and more potential for contamination. So the half-closed technique can also be performed standing, but they're far more frequently performed in with the horse in a lateral or dorsal recumbency because of that increased time and just better access when the horse is on its back.
Okay, so moving to the complication now, you mentioned scrotal swelling and edema. What are your advices regarding those?
So in terms of preventing scrotal swelling and edema, it's all about giving your client proper advice post-operatively. So we want to make sure that these horses are getting enough exercise post-operatively. So we want to not just be turning them out into a clean field, but we want to be making sure that these horses are walking around, because a horse out in a large paddock doesn't guarantee the horse is actually going to undertake an adequate amount of post-operative exercise. We also want to make sure that when we are making our scrotal incisions, that they are on the proper ventral aspect of the scrotum, because if we make our scrotal incisions slightly laterally or slightly proximally, then the incision, which is the hole in which we will promote drainage, it isn't at the most dependent part. So there's going to be a portion of the scrotum that can pull either a blood clot or serum serum fluid, and that's not going to help our drainage. And then the other thing as well that we can do in terms of preventing kind of scrotal swelling or seroma formation is to make relatively big incisions as well. We don't want to make really, really tiny incisions. And there are some surgeons that will kind of stretch their scrotal incisions at the end of the surgery just to really make sure they stay open for a long period of time. And then, as I mentioned before, it's about making sure the horse is sufficiently analgesed so that they move of their own accord. They're not stood dull because they're in pain, but they're moving of their own accord. There are risk factors for scrotal swelling. So excessive movement during surgery and bleeding are all risk factors for kind of increased post-operative swelling. So if that happens in that case, then you know, you'll really think about your management in that case post-operatively. And we know surgically that edema is usually greatest on the fourth day post-castration. So, you know, in the first 4 days, we've really got to work hard to make sure that we've got good drainage and we reduce that edema as much as possible. So that's why I think, you know, NSAIDs for at least, you know, 4 or 5 days to reduce that edema is appropriate. So that's how we would kind of prevent scrotal swelling.
Bleeding is another frequent problem and commonly the first issue noticed by the client. What is your approach?
When we're talking about bleeding, the incidence of bleeding is not uncommon. You know, it's somewhere between like 2-3% of cases. So we definitely want to have a plan for when we have these horses that bleed post-castration. Now, some bleeding post-castration is relatively normal. But if we have bleeding where we've got a drip rate so fast that we can't count it, or the rate of blood dripping is going up, or we've got an unabated stream for say 15 minutes, then those are the horses in which we want to kind of act. And we've got a couple of options. So if we can find and locate the spermatic cord, then we're going to likely find the testicular artery. And it's from the testicular artery that we get most of the bleeding. It's the most common source of bleeding. So if we can locate that spermatic cord and we have clamps, then we can apply clamps directly to the artery. Now, applying clamps very proximal, very deep, when you've got a lot of blood coming down from a scrotum in the standing patient, can be really challenging. And if I'm going back to a horse that I castrated maybe an hour or two ago, and it started bleeding, and I'm going to be thinking about applying clamps proximally in my castration site, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to drop some lidocaine with adrenaline in it, and I'm going to squirt that local anesthetic deep into my scrotal incision, because when you're almost blindly clamping, which is kind of what you have to do because you can't really look up appropriately without putting your head in a dangerous place, and you can't see a lot because there's blood dripping down. When you're blindly placing those clamps more proximally, if you catch any tissue that's not been desensitized from your surgery, or if your surgery has the time between your surgery and when you're going back out has lapsed sufficiently that your local is no longer acting, when you clamp that tissue, you can get a really violent reaction from the horse. So spraying that local up there, if it's got adrenaline in, then it might just land on some vessels and cause some vasoconstriction, which will help. But B, it will also make applying those clamps much safer. And if you can access some long-handled, right-angled clamps, then applying those clamps is also far easier. Now, actually getting the clamp can be on the spermatic cord can be really challenging, especially if you've done a castration where you've applied your emasculators very proximal. So sometimes it's not possible. So if you can't apply a clamp, and that's a pretty common scenario because applying the clamp is very challenging, then what you can do is you can pack the scrotum, and you've got a couple of different options for what you're going to pack the scrotum with. We never want to pack the scrotum with multiple small swabs. That's a bad idea, because applying 10, 12, 15 swabs into a bloody scrotum means you've got to then retrieve 10 to 12 to 15 swabs, and leaving one behind will cause serious problems down the line. So if you're going to use swabs, you want to use the big laparotomy swabs or sponges, where you'll only need one, maybe two at maximum. Another idea for applying packing that can sometimes be a lot easier to do is to unravel like a sterile knit firm bandage. And if you just want to put one in, then you can kind of unreel it off of the roll and just keep packing it in and packing it in. And then you want to leave like a long tag out of the scrotum. So when you look to the article, that's what figure three has got. It's got a knit firm packed up into the scrotum. And if you've got a big scrotal defect and you need to use maybe two knit firms, then you just tie those knit firms together in a big knot and you keep on packing in. And then you've got to think about closing the scrotal incision so that your packing doesn't fall out once you've shoved it in there. And you've got, again, you've got a couple of options for this. You can either use some big, large gauge suture and place some big cruciate sutures. Again, if it, time has delayed since you were castrating the horse and you're worried that the scrotal skin isn't desensitized, make sure you top up your local. My preference is to use towel clamps. So you can just apply two or three towel clamps across the scrotal incision. They're then much easier to remove. They're faster to apply as well. Now, if you have successfully got clamps on, or you've needed to pack and you've got towel clamps on, it's really important that you tie the tail up, because when the horse wakes up from the sedation that you've given, it will then likely swish its tail in between its legs. And I've certainly had instances where you've got young geldings that have had clamps placed and they've swished their tail in between their legs loads, and then their tail has got covered in blood and it's got wrapped in the clamps. The tail hair's got knotted in the bloody clamps, and then as they've like moved their tail vigorously and aggressively, they then ripped the clamps off and restarted bleeding. So tie the tail up. You're going to be leaving the clamps on for somewhere between like 12 to 24 hours. I always say remove the clamps at the beginning of the next day, because then you've got the rest of the next day for the horse to be monitored, and if problems occur, you've got the beginning of a day to sort them out, rather than removing clamps just before someone else is about to go on call in an evening. And again, if you've got your clamps on and you're going to take those, you're going to take your, if you've got your towel clamps and you're going to take your towel clamps off and you're going to take your packing out, again, do it at the beginning of a day. So clamps I leave on for anywhere between 12 and 24 hours. Packing I usually leave in for 24 to 48 hours and just remove them either the next day or the day after in the morning. If you've got a horse that is severely bleeding and the horse is going into cardiovascular compromise, then we're going to be needing to think about referring this horse for blood transfusions and to have a GA dorsal recumbency, identify the stump in a nice clean theater where we've got time, we can support the horse with blood transfusions and IV fluid therapy. So anytime the horse looks like it's bled a lot and you've got tachycardia, pyelomyxis membranes, those kind of things, consider referral. It's always better to have the horses kind of referred in early and little needs to be done than have a horse referred in late where the PCV has dropped significantly. Now, just touching on PCV, TP and lactate there, it's really important to remember that if you've got a horse that's bleeding, your PCV, your TP won't change significantly in the first 12 hours, really, so 6 to 12 hours, because your PCV is a measure of the proportion of red cells to plasma, and your total protein is also going to be measured proportionately. The horse has a great capacity to cause splenic contraction and dump a lot of new red cells into the body, but also because you're losing whole blood, your PCV won't change that much. So don't think just because you've got a relatively stable or high PCV, that you've got a healthy, happy horse, you can certainly get into trouble with leaving a horse too long. So one of the earliest indicators will be your peripheral lactate. If your lactate starts to climb up, it means the horse is going into anaerobic metabolism, which means it's likely dehydrated or hypovolemic. So don't get fooled by a stable PCV, because it likely won't change for the kind of first 6 to 12 hours.
Okay, and regarding infection, how would you manage a scrotal or local infection?
So your kind of scrotal swelling and your scrotal infections are one of the more common things that we'll encounter. They typically present 2 to 6 days post-castration. Now, if they're just local signs, so the scrotum's a bit swollen, a bit hot, a bit sore, a bit painful, then that's a different category to having a horse that is very systemically ill, and they're and they look very poorly. So we'll talk about the horse that kind of has local signs of infection. So that would be a pyrexia, maybe a little bit of cellulitis in the scrotum, discharge from the scrotal incisions. The way that I approach these horses is I will perform a physical examination, usually take a blood for CBC, just so that I have a baseline white cell for these horses. I'm then going to sedate the horse, examine the scrotal region, feel it for if it's hot, if it's painful, what's the pitting edema like. I'm going to assess the scrotal incisions, see what kind of discharge is coming out from those. If there's no discharge from the scrotal incisions and it looks like they've sealed and the castration only happened a couple of days ago, then those scrotal incisions have healed prematurely. So I'm going to aseptically prepare the scrotum, and then I'm going to put on my sterile gloves. And the first thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to take a bacteriology swab, and I'm going to push that through the scrotal incision, and I'm going to get a really good sample of the fluid that's in there, because I want to know what bacterium is in there. Once I've got my bacteriology swab, or I've got even a sample of fluid from the from what's in the scrotum, then I'm going to place my sterile fingers through the incision of the scrotum, and I'm going to basically open up the discharge that's in there. Now, usually what comes out is kind of a serohemorrhagic, it's not typically kind of exudative, but just kind of a foul smelling serous discharge. So I will wear, to keep myself clean, I'll wear rectal gloves, so that I've got my forearms are kind of covered, and then over the top of my rectal gloves I'll put on my sterile gloves, push my fingers through, open up, stretch the scrotal incision quite a lot. Horses can find this quite uncomfortable, and then if the scrotal incision is slightly too high or slightly too laterally, I'll make sure that I put a couple of fingers into the scrotum and I try and scoop out any blood clots or anything like that. So then the thing to think about going forward from there is, now that we've established drainage, which is the most important thing, how are we going to manage this horse post-operatively? So we're really going to have to force this post-operative exercise now to make sure that the scrotum, incisions, so we're going to really force the post-operative exercise in this horse now to make sure that the scrotal incisions stay open long enough that we get sufficient drainage, that the infection is resolved through drainage. We've got a bacteriology swab, so we're going to put that into the lab and get a bacteriology culture and then sensitivity to antimicrobials. But I usually start these horses on broad spectrum antimicrobials at this stage. I make sure that they've got sufficient analgesia on board, so the horse is happy enough that they will move around. And I want to turn these horses out into a nice clean pasture. If it's the time of year where there are flies around, I want to make sure that there's good fly treatment being applied to the scrotum, so we don't have flies getting in and involved with our surgical sites. And then again, it's just kind of reiterating to the owner that we don't want them really kind of handling or going near the scrotum incisions either. They can cold hose the scrotum and that's great, but we need to be really prescriptive, and we want to make sure they're not getting the garden hose and shoving it up into the scrotal incisions. We don't want that. We want clean cold hydrotherapy on the side of the scrotum, not in and up on our scrotal incisions. Occasionally, if I think they're really dirty, then I'll use some sterile saline and lavage out. But I don't really like the idea of lavage pushing any kind of bacterial discharge proximally into what could potentially be the abdominal cavity. So typically just opening up, providing drainage, providing broad spectrum antimicrobials, non-steroidals, and being prescriptive that the horse must be vigorously exercised to keep that drainage is important. And that's the base of how I'd approach an infection.
And how can the local infection progress and what are the consequences?
So there's a couple of there's three, I suppose, really serious progressions from infection. So the first would be a septic funiculitis. So this is an infection of the spermatic cord that travels proximally. Multiple bacteria have been cultured from these and serve fungal hyphae. So it's important to kind of have that on your radar. Risk factors for septic funiculitis include older horses, if there's been postoperative or intraoperative hemorrhage, and the open castration technique. And if there's a scrotal incisional infection, then those are all risk factors for septic funiculitis. And a septic funiculitis can present anywhere from kind of 4 months after castration to, 10 years after castration. So that's one sequelae to a scrotal infection. Another possibility would be clostridial infection, so tetanus and botulism. So we want to make sure our horses are vaccinated, and obviously clostridial infections, serious and life-threatening. And then the other sequelae really would be peritonitis or septic peritonitis. Now, trying to diagnose septic peritonitis post-castration can be quite challenging because doing belly taps on horses or doing abdominal stenosis on horses that have had a castration is very difficult to interpret. It's normal for there to be elevated total nucleated cell counts for up to 5 days following castration, to have nucleated cell counts above 10 times 10 to the power 9. So we don't use total nucleated cell count alone as an indicator for septic peritonitis. We need to do our cytological examination of the peritoneal fluid, identifying left shift neutrophils, intracellular bacteria, those kind of things. But if the horse does get a septic peritonitis, then we need to be making sure that we refer these horses in to a referral center so that they can get broad spectrum antimicrobials, NSAIDs, analgesia, supportive therapy, and in the kind of rare but serious cases, peritoneal lavage as well may also need to be performed.
Okay, and regarding other complications, what are the causes of penile damage?
So penile damage wasn't one that was on the list until a few years ago when there was a case report that was well published in EVE, and effectively through misidentifying the penis as a testicle, it was partially amputated. So really, just to avoid this complication, we just need to have a really good anatomical knowledge and know the anatomy of the area that we're working on. If you're performing a castration in dorsal recumbency, potentially consider not pushing the penis into the sheath, but actually having the penis extruded from the sheath and tied up out and out of the way would maybe likely reduce this, but really it's just good anatomical knowledge.
And what is the reported incidence for eventration and how to deal with it?
So eventration is probably the most serious complication that can follow castration. It has an incidence rate of about 1 in 1,000 to up to 3 in 100 castrations. So uncommon in some, but more common in others. There are risk factors. So standard breds and draft colts, any horse that has an enlarged inguinal ring or has had a previous inguinal hernia, or any colts that are less than 6 months old, they're at increased risk of evisceration or eventuration. So make sure we consider that. If we perform an open castration, then we are leaving a channel from the abdomen to the outside world. So we can prevent evisceration or eventuration by performing a closed castration technique and then applying a proximal ligature. Whilst the Henderson instrument is a kind of twisting and sealing mechanism for the parietal tunic, actually they still can eviscerate through that. So we really need a proximal ligature in a closed castration to kind of guarantee that we don't have eventration or evisceration. And then when it comes to actually managing the case, this is an absolute emergency. Time is critical. And there are two options that we need to discuss with the owner. either they're going to refer this horse to a referral center where the horse is going to effectively have a colic surgery, and the owners need to be prepared to fund that, or we need to euthanize the horse on welfare grounds. And that's a conversation to have when the owners first call in and they let you know that this has occurred. They need to be thinking about that decision-making process whilst you're going out to the horse. Once you arrive, if they're committed to referral, then we need to assess the horse and assess its kind of cardiovascular status. How much shock is this horse in? How do we need to support this horse? We probably want to sedate the horse because it's likely going to be distressed. We want to give broad spectrum antimicrobials. We want to give flunixin 1.1 mg per kg IV as an analgesic and as a non-steroidal. So effectively we're treating it like a colic, like a surgical colic. And then we need to protect the gut. If the gut is grossly contaminated, then we can lavage the gut using sterile saline or even clean hose water. Solution to pollution is dilution. So we want to pick off any straw, any mud, anything like that. We want to try and clean the gut as best as possible. And then we want to wrap the gut in a sterile, non-adhesive dressing. And the best thing that we can use is like a sterile impervious plastic drape. And we can form like a truss bandage. So if you look to the article, figure 4A, there's a truss bandage there just being applied where the gut's being held up and out the way. Sometimes these horses are really distressed. They'll actually trample their own intestine. So once we've got the horse in a stable condition and we're going to transport it to a referral center, once it arrives at the referral center, we're effectively going to immediately anesthetize these horses, place them in dorsal recumbency, and try to reposition the small intestine within the abdominal cavity. Depending on the amount of intestine that has eviscerated through the scrotal incision, sometimes the intestine can just be placed back via a scrotal incision and there's no ventral midline kind of standard colic incision needs to be done. But in my experience of these, it always requires a ventral midline incision to help retract the intestine back into the abdomen. And then once the intestine has been put back into the abdomen, we need to bring the intestine out of our abdominal incision, assess the viability, perform a resection or not perform a resection. And so the challenge with these cases is that they are as sick as a horse that has a strangulated small intestinal lesion, and they may or may not require a resection, but also that gut that's been contaminated by the outside world is also likely going to have then result in some form of peritonitis postoperatively, because we'll be doing some form of abdominal surgery in a dirty environment. So a very serious condition. If you are an ambulatory vet and you're called out to a horse that's eviscerated, it's useful to kind of get onto the phone to a colleague so that you can go out to the horse and provide that first aid and that immediate response. But you can send your colleague to your hospital, to your clinic, to get some sterile saline, to get the buster drapes. And it's also worthwhile calling a referral center so that they can also be ready to receive the horse so that everything happens as quickly as possible, because time is really important for these cases.
Okay, and how do we recognize a mental prolapse and what is the management?
Where evisceration kind of sends shivers down you and it sends you into panic mode, a mental prolapse isn't something that is as serious. So this is where you might get a call from the owner and they say, oh, there's a bit of something hanging out, I'm not sure what it is. And what we want to do is we want to go out to the horse, we want to examine it, do a clinical examination, sedate the horse, and then we want to examine the tissue that's prolapsing. Determining a momentum from mesentery can be really hard, especially if you're not a surgeon, you're not doing colic surgery, you don't know the differences. But a momentum effectively is kind of like a curtain-like tissue that doesn't really have any big vessels running through it. It has a lot of fat running through it and it'll be quite friable. So if we have a mental prolapse, the way we're going to manage this is we're going to sedate the horse, give it a dose of antimicrobials, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, and then we're going to clean the scrotal region. And then if we're confident it's a momentum and not anything else more vital, then we're going to draw the omentum down until we get fresh omentum, push the scrotal incision up, and then apply our emasculators. We're going to emasculate the prolapsed omentum. Now, the reason this omental prolapse occurs is because, again, we performed an open castration. The omentum that lies within the abdomen has migrated to the inguinal canal. It's migrated down the inguinal ring into the parietal tunic, and then it's popping out the parietal tunic. So we can prevent this by performing a closed castration, and that may be something we need to do. If we deal with this omentum, as I've said, by emasculating it proximally where it's nice and clean, and more comes out, then the horse needs to be referred so that we can properly close the inguinal ring and we can stop this happening again. If you emasculate the omentum proximally in a nice clean area and no more comes out, then we want to stall rest these horses for a couple of days. And the hope is that either that omentum will retract back into the abdomen, or it will stay within the inguinal canal, but it will kind of form adhesions and it will get locked in there. So it will block the inguinal canal from anything else kind of prolapsing further.
Okay, and you mentioned in your paper that colic is a possible complication post-castrations. What are the differential related to it, and how to recognize them and manage them?
So this is always a challenge when a horse colics after castration. We've got to remember colic just means abdominal pain or abdominal discomfort, and there's numerous reasons why a horse might colic. So we really just need to approach these horses like we would approach our normal colic. So a good clinical examination, and we need to have on our list of differentials either colic associated with the castration or colic that is completely nothing to do with our castration and it's bad luck, or maybe it's a consequence of the sedation. So I would approach these horses pretty much in the same way and think, okay, do I have a primary gastrointestinal lesion, or do I have a horse that is uncomfortable because I've castrated him earlier on in the day? And through experience of castrating horses, you'll get a reasonable kind of baseline of what you think is an acceptable amount of discomfort post-castration and what you think is an unacceptable amount. But just being really thorough in your colic examination when you go out to see the horse is important, because you don't want to miss a primary intestinal problem like a large colon displacement or a pelvic flexor impaction or a cecal impaction, or even something really bizarre like a large colon or a small intestinal strangulating lesion, and just kind of pass it off as post-castration colic. That's why the clinical exam, your rectal, passing a nasogastric tube, ultrasound if you have it, is really important to make sure that you're not missing gastrointestinal pathology.
Okay, what kind of long-term complication can we experience after castration?
So long-term complications, so your septic funiculitis, which you spoke about earlier, that can be a complication that presents up to kind of 10 years post-castration in one report. Other long-term complications might be the formation of a hydrocele. So this is a accumulation of peritoneal fluid within the parietal tunic or the vaginal sac, and that can appear months to years after castration. Your hydroceles are they only form after open castration, and that's due to the retention of the parietal tunic, and they're effectively just a cosmetic blemish. So they don't need to be dealt with surgically unless the owner wants them dealt with, and the treatment is surgical resection under GA. I suppose the other long-term complication might be if you're castrating the horse because you don't like the way he behaves and he isn't being a good boy, then he might continue to be naughty or show stallion-like behavior. The libido of a horse following castration slowly declines over about 2 months, but castration doesn't guarantee the elimination of those masculine behaviors, and geldings can show stallion-like behavior, mounting, erection, those kind of things, in up to 20 or 30% of cases. So it's a conversation to have with owners to make sure they understand that castrating your horse doesn't guarantee a docile gelding. You can still get a badly behaved horse without testicles as well as one with.
So this leads us to the last question. How to approach a gelding with a stallion-like behavior then?
So if you've gelded the horse, and you've seen two testicles, two epididymises, and the horse's continued stallion like behaviour, then there's not real much investigation to be done. However, if you're presented with a gelding that is showing stallion like behaviour and the owner or you are unsure of the castration history, then we want to be thinking, is there retained androgen producing tissue in this horse? So is there a retained testicle somewhere? And one of the most sensitive indicators for this is the anti-Müllerian hormone assay. Very easy to perform and do. And this is really the only thing that needs to happen before the horse is referred to a referral center if the anti-Müllerian hormone is elevated. Because once we get a horse that comes to the clinic with elevated anti-Müllerian hormone, we're then going to start to think, okay, where is the testicle? So it's either going to be inguinal or abdominal, because we expect most referring veterinary surgeons to be able to look and see if there's a testicle in the scrotum or not. And once we know that there is testicle tissue, then we can use a rectal examination, ultrasound, and laparoscopy to figure out where that testicle tissue is.
All right, that was brilliant, Chris. Thank you so much. I hope you guys enjoyed it and see you soon.
Thanks, Kiara.
Thank you for listening to this Equine Veterinary Education podcast. More on the subjects discussed in this podcast can be found online at wileyonlinelibrary.com/journal/eve.